the stored energy in that inductor? Yes or no?
No.
How much energy is stored in the inductor during the second hour?
Zero.
I've got half an ampere flowing. A half an ampere into the inductor is zero stored energy, but one ampere was half a joule.
It's also zero.
When you told me it was half a joule before, you were fibbing?
No, I'm just saying, if you have DC, if there's just DC on an inductor, and you have one ampere through it, half an ampere, steady state, no voltage change on the inductor, the energy stored at that particular moment is zero.
If I've got half an ampere or one ampere flowing into an inductor steady state, is there a magnetic field in that inductor, yes or no?
Yeah, there is, but it's in a steady state at that particular point in time, and there's nothing stored because the voltage across the inductor at that point is zero.
Ah, we've gotten to the nit of the problem here. You're telling me that if I've got an inductor with a small enough equivalent series resistance, such that there is a series that's very close to zero volts flowing across it, when one ampere is flowing through it, the one ampere you're admitting is making a magnetic field, and the magnetic field can be there for an hour, and you're telling me the magnetic field inside of that inductor for that hour represents zero amount of joules of stored energy. A magnetic field is not a stored energy? Run that by again, Glenn.
Until something changes, in other words, if you have a voltage change across the inductor or something else actually moves at that point in time, the energy at that moment or over that time frame with zero voltage change is zero.
No, I'm not asking for the rate of change of energy. I'm asking how much energy is there. I know that there's a hell of a lot of energy there, because if I walk over there while an ampere is flowing for the last hour and I suddenly yank that wire out, I'm going to get an inductive kickback. That spark is going to make me jump like crazy. That, to me, is damn real energy. Where the hell did that come from if it wasn't for the collapsing magnetic field? There is energy in that inductor when a steady state 1 ampere is flowing. There's real magnetic field. That is stored energy in my book.
It is. It's like a capacitor with a voltage on it just sitting there with nothing happening. That's correct. But there's no change at that moment of time.
There is real energy in that inductor, obvious by the fact that I can break the circuit and draw an arc. And all of that energy of that arc came from inside that inductor. There was energy in that inductor for the last hour. Steady state energy in joules that I could read. Not a change until I opened up the wire. It didn't change. There is real magnetic field. There is stored energy in that magnetic field. And I can get it back out by creating that inductive kickback, by opening that circuit. And if my finger's across that man, I'm going to jump. Over to you, Glenn.
Right on. And I think that's where the communication barrier right now is breaking. We're mixing two sets of terms here. One set of terms is voltage at a steady state, current at a steady state. Those two states represent one set of energy stored equations. Then you have moving energy. So when you're talking about energy change in an inductor, okay, then you have the LDIDT issue. So when the energy is going to leave the inductor, you have to have a voltage change across the inductor. Same with the capacitor. A specific fixed value of stored energy in the capacitor uses the equation. So a fixed voltage at that point represents that much energy in the capacitor. But when the energy, when the voltage starts to change with respect to time, CdVdt at that point in time, now you've got the change in energy. When you put the two inside a parallel circuit and you look at the energy change between an L and a C in motion over the sine wave, what's actually happening is the energy inside the capacitor and the energy in the inductor are voltage dependent. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Since the usual formula for energy in a capacitor is 1/2 C V squared, assuming that C is fixed, I know what the energy is in the capacitor if I know the voltage on the capacitor. Do you agree with that so far?
Yes, you do.
In the case of an inductor, the stored energy in the inductor is 1/2 LI squared. There is no voltage term in that formula. Stored energy in joules in an inductor is 1/2 LI squared. You agree or disagree?
Agreed. Steady state.
So, if I told you the inductance in Henry, and if I told you the current in amperes, and I did not tell you the voltage on the inductor. Can you tell me how much energy in joules is in the inductor? I've told you henries. I've told you amperes. I did not tell you voltage. Can you tell me henries? Can you tell me joules in that inductor? Yes or no?
Absolutely. Steady state joules. That's correct.
Okay. If the current is now a sloping current, and I know that it's following a cosine waveform, and I measure the current at each one of those degrees of the argument of the cosine, can I tell you the amount of joules of energy in the inductor at each one of those degrees, as long as I know the current at each one of those degrees? Over to you.
In the parallel LC, no.
I'm just talking about an inductor. I'm putting a sine wave of current through an inductor. And at each one of those degrees of the argument of the cosine, that sine wave, let's call it a cosine wave. I got a cosine wave of current I'm putting through an inductor. At each one of those arguments of the cosine, I know exactly how much current is flowing. Can I use the formula at each one of those 1 degree increments of the argument of the cosine? If I know the current, can I tell you the number of joules at each one of those 1 degree increments? Do you agree?
I think you with a resistor, yes, you can.
Why can't I do it with a constant current power supply with no resistor? If I know the current flowing through the inductor, and if I really believe 1/2 Li squared equals joules, if I know the magnitude of current at each one of those degrees of argument of cosine, why don't I know the number of joules in the inductor at each one of those degrees, even though it's changing?
Because you don't know the voltage integral at that time. In other words, you'd have to look at each, if you look at the inductor over time t, and depending on the waveform that's across it, you have to know the incident voltage, you have to know the incident current, the inductance, and then look at the angle slope on that, then you'll know the magnetic flux change over time t, and then you can determine the energy at that point.
That's one way to do it, and it's not the only way. If you believe that the joules is 1/2 Li squared, and there is no voltage term in that formula, is that formula lying to me? If I don't tell you the voltage, but I tell you the current, can't you tell me the number of joules at each instant of time in that inductor?
Only if it's steady state. In other words, if it's not moving, that's correct. In other words, if it's a, if you have a situation where there's nothing moving, or it's, I think in certain cases of linearity, if you've got linear, it also applies. I have to look at that a little bit closer, but I do know that over complex waveforms, it falls apart real fast. You've got to be very, very careful with that.
Is a cosine waveform a complex waveform? Oh, yeah. If I'm looking at the voltage, I'm putting a sine wave...
When it's in parallel with the capacitor, yes.
Let me test the capacitor all by itself, and I'm feeding it with some kind of a power supply like that. And I'm creating a sine wave on the capacitor, and the voltage is continuously changing in a sinusoidal manner, except for the positive peak and the negative peak where it goes to the zero slope. Other than that, the voltage is continuously changing. As the voltage changes on the capacitor, and I apply the formula 1/2 CV squared, does that formula tell me the amount of energy in that capacitor for each one of those magnitudes of voltage that I know about, even though I didn't tell you the current? Can you tell me the amount of joules in the capacitor for each instantaneous voltage? Do you agree or disagree?
Agree.
If I can do that with voltage on a capacitor, why can't I do that with inductance, current on an inductor? The exact same formula type, joules equals 1/2 Li squared. There's no voltage. By the way, let's go back to that capacitor term. You were able to tell me the amount of energy in the capacitor when I told you the voltage, and I didn't tell you the current. Why can't I, by the corresponding technique, know the amount of energy in the inductor when I tell you the current and I don't tell you the voltage? What's the difference?
There's an area problem with the inductor. If you take, like an example, I'll give you a perfect example of it. If you have a magnet and you measure the voltage across the magnet is zero and you know the magnetic field, what's the energy level of the magnet, Dick?
There's a lot more variables required in the case of a magnet.
It's the same with an inductor as well.
But it's a mixed bananas with apples. It's quite different.
The same, Wesley, it is the same. With a magnet,
steady state that was discussed before and the sine wave is exactly of the same nature. The only time of the interval is different.
Oh, one is charging and discharging as opposed to steady state. There is difference with an inductor. When you have changing LDIDT on an inductor, the energy at each level is changing. Not power, not other things, but energy is changing along the sine wave.
But it was told, it was... The 1 ampere over the 1 hour, and then you rapidly discharge, then you have a pool of the energy being existing in the circuit. Now, you have a certain level, and then you go to the zero level, right? Now, with the capacitor, and the inductor, when you have the sine wave, you have exactly the same mechanism. The only difference is, so it changed from the potential to the kinetic energy. The only difference is the time factor.
You and I disagree, apparently, Glenn, on can you have a changing current on an inductor, but still at each instant of time, knowing the amount of current and the formula 1/2 Li², I say you know the amount of stored magnetic energy in the inductor at each instant.
But the current has a phasor with respect to the voltage. That's what determines the energy.
Disagree. The instantaneous current on the inductor tells you the exact magnitude of the magnetic field.
Okay, I'm going to have to send you an email during the week, Dick. K2RIW, K2QIQ. Guys, I got to get up for work early tomorrow. We'll have to pick this one up later.
Okay, are you saying 1/2 Li² does not equal energy in joules? Why are we teaching our students that formula if it's not true?
It does, Dick, in steady state. It absolutely does. But over a sine wave in a parallel LC network, I have to show you something.
The similar formula works on a capacitor but doesn't work in an inductor. Okay. We both got to go to sleep. Got to go to work the next morning. And we'll eventually get to the bottom of this. And you and I will both look up some references to try to support our point of view. And maybe the smoke will eventually settle. And maybe we'll find out what's going on.
Dick, one more question. If you can defer the difference, tell me the difference between dumped wave and sandy wave.
This means the Scopes trial.
Yeah, but what was the name of the great attorney there?
William Jenny Bryan.
Okay, he was the strongly religious person. Which one of us is the strongly religious person in your opinion, John?
I don't know, you both sound like atheists to me.
That ain't clear. Okay, your question was damped versus, what was that again, Wes?
Standing wave.
Standing wave versus what? What was the alternate you wanted to know about?
Damped wave versus standing wave.
Oh, yeah, they're very different. You can picture a bowstring constrained at the left-hand side and the right-hand side. You can tap your finger on the bowstring near the left-hand support, and if the camera is running fast enough, you can watch a pulse walk down that wire, hit the far end of constraint, the pulse will reverse in magnitude and come back to you. So far, you're getting that picture. I can take the guy wire on my tower. I can tap on the guy wire while I'm sighting my eye along the wire. I can see that pulse go up the tower, strike the tower, reverse in polarity because it thinks it sees a short circuit, and that pulse comes back down to me. So far, are you seeing that particular picture?
I do.
And at the instant of time that the pulse goes up toward the tower, hits the tower, and is starting to come back down, I hit the guy wire a second time. So I'm creating a second pulse going up the wire while the first one is coming back down. Take my word for it, the two of them will fold through each other in the center of that wire, as if the other pulse is not there. They're thoroughly independent events. All transmission lines obey that rule. The signal flowing to the right and the signal flowing to the left do not see each other, even though they came from the exact same source. They do not see each other. That's when a transmission line is running in a linear manner. You can also see this with a pool of water. Drop a pebble into the north side of the pool, watch the wave travel to the south. Drop a pebble into the south side of the pool, watch the wave travel to the north. Drop a pebble into the north and south side of the pool, watch those two waves fold from each other like they're not there. Okay. So now that you know that there's independence of the wave going up and independence of the wave coming back, let me drop. I could, if I time it just right, continuously make waves going up, they're continuously reflecting off the tower, and they're coming back down. And if I choose the timing just right, it will appear that certain portions of the wire are continuously waving up and down. A quarter wavelength further up is a null point, a node, where the wire is just twisting back and forth but not moving. And then another quarter wave further forward, the wave will be moving up and down again, but out of phase with the first one. So I can set up a standing wave. When you set a bowstring at a certain length on your violin and you pull the bow across it, you are setting up a standing wave. There really is a wave going from the left side to the right side of the wire and a wave going from the right side to the left side. That is a standing wave, and usually it's some odd number or even number of quarter wavelengths of wire for that particular frequency. You get that picture so far?
Yes, I do.
That is a standing wave. A standing wave, as long as you've got either an extremely low loss or you've got a continuous driving function, continuously operating a signal generator, the standing wave can be absolutely constant in amplitude for the next hour. It doesn't have to be damped. Yes, if you turn off the forcing function, you stop drawing the bow, or you turn off the signal generator, the wave will damp out in some period of time, depending on the cue of that network. So yes, a standing wave can become a exponential decay wave. It doesn't have to. As long as you continuously have the forcing function, the standing wave can be there forever. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Okay, now, we have a coil made from the Varcher cable. Each piece of wire has its own capacitance and inductance, and that stands for the impedance. Now, instead of connecting a two ends of the coil, now, let's see, it doesn't matter what is the capacitive factor of the coil. We connect one wire, which would be the braid, and the other wire, that would be the inner wire. Do you see this picture so far?
I think you've got a length of coaxial cable, and you've shorted the center conductor to the braid on at least one end, and maybe you're going to do that on the other end. Back to you.
John, can you explain it?
I'll give it a try. What he's doing is he has a little power supply. He connects the output power supply to the braid. Center conductor is free. At the other end, he's going to use the center conductor as the output. So it appears to me that he's talking about a capacitance coupling.
The power supply is AC power supply.
Okay. And if the frequency of the signal generator that's driving the braid is low enough so that the length of the coaxial cable is a small fraction of a wavelength at that frequency, then you could, if you want to, calculate the simple amount of capacitance between center conductor and braid, and that's the series capacitor that's feeding your load. You could do it that way if the frequency is low enough. And I know where you're going to go as you start raising the frequency. And I think I know a possible answer to this. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
60 hertz.
At 60 hertz, where the wavelength is, I'm going to pick a number, 5 miles long, and you're not using 5 miles of coaxial cable, then you can calculate the number of picofarad per foot of your particular coax cable. I think it's something like 27 picofarad per foot, or is it per inch? But you can look it up and you can calculate it. And that is a simple series capacitor when you're running at 60 hertz. Start going up to RF and other things are going to happen. Over to you.
Okay, now, let me drop.
KC2, QIQ, I'm back with Second Wind.
Wow. I'm listening to you, Glenn.
Just a quick comment, Dick, about maximum stored energy in the inductor when the voltage is at zero is at maximum in the inductor. I take that one back.
Okay, I think I understand. Now, I think you're slowly beginning to admit that the energy flips back and forth between an inductor and capacitor on each quarter cycle of that ring down. Are we almost in agreement on that one?
Energy stored, that's correct.
So as we go through 0 volts, no energy on the capacitor, but all the energy is in the inductor as we go through 0. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. Stored energy inside the inductor at 0 is 0 volts, is basically maximum energy stored in the inductor and 0 energy stored in the capacitor.
Well done. We're making progress. I think we ought to let you go to sleep. We've made enough progress for one night. I'm not going to push it. Would you, Glenn?
Yeah, no, I agree, Dick. But there is something I want to show you over the week about that 90 percentile at the first cycle in transfer of energy and what actually is happening between the two elements. K2RW, KC2, QIQ, 73 to Dick, and have a good evening.
Okay, Glenn. Glenn was still friendly on this one because for a while there we were going pretty strong.
Dick, does that mean that all of the energy is now in the magnetic field of the coil for the inductor?
I say yes. When you've got a parallel LC network, and this is a controversial one, not everyone will agree to this one at first. I've been down this road a few times by people who have been well educated in normal schooling techniques, that at the instant it goes through 0 volts, all of the energy of the parallel LC network is in the inductor. As it goes through maximum peak voltage, all the energy is in the capacitor. On each quarter cycle, they're flipping back and forth. They're flipping back and forth, believe it or not, a total of 2 complete cycles of flipping back and forth, four complete flips, so to speak, per individual sine wave. That's a wild circuit if you think about it. Over to you, John, K2RW.
Okay, yeah, I thought you were going in the right direction with that, and it sounds like that fits. So I just want to make sure I'm getting the information correctly filed in my brain. Over to you, Dick.
Dick, how about if we change now the sine wave to the square wave, and we achieve a nanosecond rise and fall time?
You're talking about feeding your coax cable now. What you've got to do...
No, forget about the coax cable now. Just come to that what we discussed for two hours. Back to you.
Okay. If there is a reasonable inductor and capacitor with reasonably high Q, obvious by the fact that it rings down in 1,000 cycles for half magnitude of voltage, that's a very high Q circuit. When you've got a circuit with that high in Q, it has one and only one fundamental frequency of resonance. You try to put any other frequency in there, and you're going to think you're looking into a short circuit. Really get a circuit that rings down that low. It's a very high Q circuit. It's got one frequency of resonance, no harmonics, nothing else. You give it that frequency, or you don't get any response at all. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but in the case of your square wave, you're trying to give it a whole lot of odd harmonics. It will look like a short circuit to those odd harmonics. With any finite impedance signal generator feeding that LC network, there'll be nothing there but the fundamental sine wave, and everything else will disappear.
Yes, but we will have one advantage. We try to maintain a very, very short rise time and a fall time.
Yeah, when you build a real inductor and a real capacitor on a real LC network, the capacitor has got some series inductance, the inductance has some shunt capacitance, and the world is a little bit more complicated. But in theory, if I'm careful enough, I can build a very low capacitance inductor, I can build a very low inductance capacitor, I can put the two together, and if I've got a small enough series equivalent resistance on each of those components, it'll ring down in 1,000 cycles to half amplitude. It's an extremely high Q circuit. It'll allow the fundamental frequency to appear across it, and you can huff and puff as hard as you want. You really won't get any significant amount of any other frequency across that circuit. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
That applies for an antenna also, Dick, doesn't it?
Whoa, be careful now. Every antenna you and I normally use, John, is really a distributed piece of wire in space. As such, it is not a pure inductor, it's not a pure capacitor. it's much more complicated. Even though it looks like a very simple piece of wire, it's a much more complicated circuit. Now I have the ability to put a whole lot of frequencies in there. Any reasonable piece of wire, I can feed it at the fundamental, the odd, and all the odd harmonics, and I get a reasonable impedance at all the odd harmonics. I can put all of those odd harmonics onto your dipole, John. Oh, dear, John.
But, Dick, if we had an antenna that could be built with a Q of a million, then we would have the same constraints, don't we?
If I build a pure antenna with a pure, what was that again? I missed some word. It sounded like minion. Go ahead.
If we had a Q of 1 million, similar to the inductor setup that you were talking about before, then the same constraints would apply with it.
Yes, but it's not an antenna anymore. See, by definition, and you're putting energy into an antenna, cyclic energy, and although it doesn't jump directly off the wire into space, you have to kick that energy 10 or 20 times by resonance. Every reasonable antenna that you transmit with, you will resonate first, then you can radiate. Resonate means you're setting up what really is a standing wave on the antenna, which gives you a current multiplication and a voltage multiplication, and that enhances the radiation. So by definition, you're losing energy continuously. That's called radiation. If I completely shield the antenna, if I make your dipole out of coaxial cable, and I leave the shield on, and I drill two little holes in the shield in the center so I can feed the piece of wire in the center that I call dipole, but it's completely shielded. And if I use low enough loss coax cable, I can make the Q very high. But by definition, it doesn't radiate. If it radiates, the Q must be quite a bit lower. Otherwise, you're not radiating. Can't have it both ways. Got to obey conservation of energy. If you want high Q, you cannot radiate. Over to you, John.
Okay, Dick. Understood. I'll pick it up with Wes. Don't want you to pull the time.
Got it, Wes.
Okay. So, we have a certain length of the wire. It's coiled. Well, it looks like a coil. One side is connected to the plate. The other side is connected to the central conductor. Now, by definition, we have a LC resonant circuit, because we have the capacitance, and then we have the inductance. Now, because it does have a higher capacitance, it works as a capacitor. Now, we're trying to feed that from the second coil, the second coil is like an air transformer, okay, next to it. By the time we give a short impulse from the coil, the energy of the other coil is stored, and because of the larger capacitance of that, the energy is still in the second coil while the other impulse comes in. Back to you.
Okay, you've gone about 3 steps downrange a little bit fast. You didn't have to coil the coax. If you leave the coax as a straight out piece of coax, you've got a signal generator at one end feeding the braid and nothing touching the center conductor at that end. At the other end, you've got the center conductor going to something you call load. That, believe it or not, is a resonant circuit right there before you coil it. Should I prove that to you? Over to you.
No, you don't have to prove it. You're right completely 100% on the money. What I'm trying to do is right now change something. Let's say this coil is the secondary coil, and the primary coil is the coil that has a generator into it. Now we have a secondary coil, which is one braid is connected, where the braid is connected from one side and the central conductor from the other side. Now, we're feeding it with the very fast rise time pulses. And what is happening is, because of the increased impedance on the secondary, before this energy is able to dissipate, the another impulse comes from the primary. Did you get a picture?
The first piece of coax cable, the signal generator goes to the braid, the center conductor goes to the load. And then you took that particular piece of coax cable and coiled it some number of turns. Is that true?
Can you explain it?
Dick, what I think he's trying to say is we take that same piece of coax cable, we're going to feed a pulse into it, and before the load can use up all of the stored energy in the capacitance of the coaxial cable, he's going to hit it with another pulse. I believe that's what he's saying.
However, let's go slow on this one. The pulse really is by Fourier series. It's a whole bunch of individual frequencies. If it's a square wave pulse, it's got nothing but odd harmonics, fundamental third, fifth, seventh, and so on. What we should do first is to take that signal generator feeding the braid, and the semiconductor goes to the load. We should do nothing but sweep the signal generator up in frequency to see what happens. And you'll see some magic. At the frequency where the semiconductor, in its dielectric of the coax cable, is a quarter wavelength lower. When you go to that frequency, say for instance you, 432 megacycles, a wavelength is 27 inches, quarter wave is what? let's make it 6 inches as a quarter wave. If the semiconductor is 6 inches long, and you slowly sweep the frequency to 432 megacycles, so now the semiconductor is a quarter wavelength long. Let's look from the load point of view. From the load point of view, you look down that semiconductor, and a quarter wavelength away, it's an open circuit. A quarter wave of any transmission line is an impedance inverter. The quarter wave open circuit will, at the input end, look like a perfect short circuit between semiconductor and braid at the load end, I should say. The load end, at the quarter wavelength frequency, will see a perfect short circuit. You will think the amount of capacitance between the braid and the semiconductor has just gone to infinity. You'll think that somebody has shorted the two together, because at that frequency, your coax cable, semiconductor to braid, is now a short circuit. I wonder if you can see that one, John. KC2 GW.
Repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
KC2 WGB. K2 RIW.
Yes, Dick, I completely understand that. Yes.
So when you put square waves down this transmission line, at certain frequencies, it's a simple capacitor. At certain frequencies, it's a dead short circuit. Go a little bit higher than that frequency, and now it's not a capacitor, it's an inductor. You will think there is an inductor between the braid and the semiconductor. So by slowly sweeping one single frequency into this thing, you'll make some very interesting measurements of signal coupled through from the signal generator to the load. And once you know how it behaves on each one of those frequencies, and once you know that your square wave is made up of fundamental plus all of those odd frequencies, you can figure out now how each one of the frequencies that really are inside that square wave, how they're going to behave. Therefore, you can reconstruct the waveform by the laws of superposition. You can figure out what waveform is going to get to that load. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, understood. Leslie, why don't you describe what you were going to get to?
The result, I'm going to be very cautious in it. It happened to be in the past. okay. Now, let's say we have another scenario. We have two coils. One is a regular coil from the wire, and the other one is a coil that is made from the coaxial cable. Now, the first coil from the regular wire has the generator connected into it. Through the through the induction, we have a signal on the coaxial cable. But the coaxial cable, one wire, one end is connected to the braid, and the other one is connected, is the central conductor is connected to, let's say, the load. Here's what's happened. I'm trying to feed to the primary, the regular coil, a signal with the very short rise time and a fall time. Before the energy from the secondary is able to dissipate, The primary is feeding it with the another impulse. Do you see the picture, John? Dick.
I think you've got a coil of wire, and I think you've got a coil of coax cable. And are these two coils parallel to each other? Who is the signal generator, and who is the load? And there's a lot of missing information as far as the physical layout of these two coils. I get the impression that one is a bare piece of wire coil, and the other is a coaxial cable fed shield from the signal generator and semiconductor to the load. And by the way, we got to go back a little bit when you had nothing but the straight-out piece of coax cable fed from the signal generator feeding the shield and the semiconductor feeding the load. There was one other portion of that circuit that was not well-defined. Was that signal generator and was that load both sitting on a great big sheet of metal? Because, in theory, one wire cannot feed a circuit. It takes two wires. The grounding of the signal generator, if it was grounded to a sheet of metal, and the load takes two wires, was the second wire of the load grounded to the sheet of metal? But then you've got a defined circuit. If you really hang that in air, the signal generator can't feed just one wire. The load can't be fed by just one wire. So the very simple circuit in the beginning had quite a bit of unknown information as to how the circuit was being completed. N2XJN, K2LAW.
N2XJN, okay. Well, instead of the generator, I can use the one transistor oscillator. Doesn't matter what it is. It's the source of the signal. Now, of course, the oscillator is grounded, but I have a problem with what you say. Let's say it's not grounded. Let's say we have a one end of the coaxial cable connected to one connection of the center of the BNC connector, and the other one connected to the outer one. Still, at a certain frequency, the coaxial cable will react as a resonant circuit. Back to you.
You said an ambiguity. The semiconductor of the BNC connector of the signal generator went to the braid of the coax cable. And you said the outer conductor of the BNC went to the other. That doesn't compute. Went to the other what? Where did the grounding of the signal generator go? Over to you, Wes.
The first scenario that we discussed, we have a center conductor and the braid, right? Now, normally what we would do is we would put the BNC connector on the end of it and just feed it into the connection, BNC connection on the generator. Instead of that, what we do is we take a braid from one side and connect to the, let's say, center pin of the BNC connector. And we take the center conductor from the other end of the coaxial cable and connect it to the ground of the BNC connector at the generating side. Back to you.
Okay, so the coax cable is a great big U-shape. Braid is going to center conductor, and then at the end of the coax cable, which you bent back into a U-shape, center conductor now goes to the ground of the BNC. Is that what you're saying? Go ahead.
That's correct.
Yeah, that U-shape, you didn't tell me that before, and you told me it's going to the load. Now I understand. So what you've got is a distributed capacitor. A distributed capacitor is the way you're using that coax cable. And when you hit the frequency where the coax cable is electronically a quarter wavelength long, if the coax cable is low enough in loss, the signal generator at that frequency will think it's looking into a zero ohm impedance. If that signal generator really was a network analyzer, then it's going to see a series of shorts and opens in frequency. The first short will take place where the coax cable is electronically a quarter wavelength long. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Beautiful answer.
So where it's a quarter wavelength long, you're going to see a short. where it's a half wavelength long, you're going to see a perfect open circuit, no capacitance at all. So at the quarter wavelength frequency, you'll think you have an infinite number of picofarads. At the half wavelength frequency, you'll think you have zero capacitance, a perfect open circuit, and it will keep alternating after that. And now when you feed that with a square wave, which has all these odd harmonics, you can figure out which of the frequencies are going to see shorts and which are going to see opens, and your square wave is going to become distorted. Unless that signal generator has 0 ohms of impedance, you're not going to have a very clean-looking square wave anymore. KC2XJN, K2LAW.
Okay, N2XJN. Now, the second scenario was that we have two coils. One coil is a regular coil made out of the regular copper wire. Now, two ends of this coil are connected to the generator. This coil is coupled, it's an air coil, with another coil made from the piece of the coaxial cable. Now, that coaxial cable, let's say the first example would be, is not connected anywhere. But we're trying to find out what would be a voltage with the very sensitive high voltage voltmeter between the braid on one side and the center conductor on the second one. Did you get a picture?
Yes, I think so. The first coil is just a bare piece of wire, which maybe has got a couple of turns to it, or is also in a U-shape. And when that piece of wire going from center conductor through the U-shape back to the shield of the BNC connector, that also is going to have a peculiar resonance phenomenon. When that is a half wavelength long, that particular coil at a half wavelength long will look a little bit like a short circuit, except for the fact that it's doing some radiating. At a quarter wavelength long, it'll be an open circuit. At a half wavelength long, it'll be a short circuit. It's going to be doing the opposite of what the coax cable did. And now you're going to lay another piece of coax cable close to the first coil, and you're going to try to figure out what voltage it picks up. Is that what I think you're doing? And is the motivation here to get voltage multiplication? Over to you, Wes, K2LAW.
The motivation in here is to prove the fact that because the second coil has significant capacitive factor, it reacts at the right frequency as a capacitor. Therefore, in the right application, the energy on the second coil could not dissipate as of yet when the second impulse came from the first coil, feeding the energy still being there in the second one.
Yeah, your first coil, as you slowly sweep the frequency, that's the one where you're feeding the braid and the center conductor in this loop. At certain frequencies, it's a pure capacitor. As you go up in frequency, it becomes an infinite capacitor, a perfect short circuit. You go a little bit higher in frequency, it's an inductor. And it's going to alternate between inductor, short, capacitor, open, inductor, short, capacitor, open. It's going to keep in alternating back and forth as you go up in frequency. It's going to have a peculiar frequency response because it looks like a simple piece of coax cable. And if you try to generate that with lumped inductors and capacitors, it would be very difficult. There's a lot more to that circuit than first meets the eye. So it's got shorts, opens, inductors, and capacitors, depending on what frequency. Your other coil that's inductively feeding it is going to be looking at a very variable load. Over to you, Wes.
I think I have properly redefined the question. Okay. Forget about what we said before. We have a regular coil connected to the BNC connector of the generator. One coil. On the top of that coil, we wind a coil from the coaxial cable. And we take left-hand side braid and right-hand side center conductor. Now we have a transformer, air transformer, where the first coil is a regular coil and the second one is made out of the coaxial cable. And because the capacitance of that secondary coil of the transformer, that air transformer, is larger than at the right frequency and the right rise time, we will have a situation, or we will not have a situation, in which we will have a still stored energy in the secondary that could not dissipate when the another input from the primary came in, feeding that rest that energy level on the secondary with the new energy.
I accept that. What you've made here is an extremely complicated air IF can. You've made an intermediate frequency can, IF can, from an old-fashioned radio. But you've made a very complicated version where the primary and secondary, the primary is made out of an ordinary coil of wire, and the secondary is this unusual coax shield and center conductor thing. And now you've got a detector on that output coil. And yes, you can set it up in such a way that is resonant, and before the decay of the first waveform occurs, the second waveform is supporting it and building up to a larger waveform. Whether you resonate a coil and it builds up voltage, by the way, I can also take an LC network that's got 10 turns to the coil and a parallel inductor and capacitor, and I put my signal generator one turn up on the 10-turn coil. At resonance, the voltage on the top of the coil will be 10 times bigger than the voltage coming out of the signal generator. You're going to get a somewhat similar effect in the network that you're describing. By the way, in that 10-turn LC, and you're feeding one turn with a signal generator, you really are making a ringing circuit, and before the first cycle rings down, you're hitting it with the second cycle. That's part of how it builds up a much bigger voltage. So there's lots of ways of getting resonance. Resonance gives you a voltage rise or a current rise, and one of the definitions of Q of a resonant circuit is how much voltage rise did you get at resonance. A circuit with a Q of 10 somewhere has a voltage that's 10 times higher or a current that's 10 times higher. Voltage rise at current at resonance or current rise at resonance is one of the definitions of Q. Another one is energy dissipated per cycle versus energy stored per cycle. Another one is bandwidth divided into center frequency. There's four or five definitions of Q. But voltage rise at resonance is one of them, and you're building a circuit that could potentially have voltage rise at resonance. It's not magic. It's a more complicated IF can. N2XJN, K2RIW.
We can't have the increase in voltage and current.
Thank you very much, and it's a big day for me. Thank you, Dick. John, go to... John, can you go upstairs? John, go upstairs.
to us, it will go. We blow their horn. I don't know if they get nervous because I'm on the boat. I'm a menace to the highway or what?
Alright. Well, so I got debris in the road. Looks like pieces of wood all over the place. Something fell off something, it looks like. Alright, you want to laugh?
Go ahead.
You know Big John Ized, right?
Oh, I get him confused with Adam, this guy Adam. A2Q Ized. So go ahead.
Big John Ized. Wow, we have... Wow, look at this. There's like 10 cars over here with flat tires. Anyway, yesterday, we had a table over at the Landmark Campfest for our club. And Ized's asked by the membership chairman of Landmark, did you pay your dues? We haven't gotten your dues yet. So Big John Ized turns around and looks at our treasurer and membership chairperson and goes, Tom, did I pay my dues? And Mick goes, yeah, you paid your dues. And then Jerry goes, no, I'm at the Landmark. We're a repeater club. And Ized goes, well, I'm a CW operator and I don't care.
Oh, my God. What, are they pushing that now? What is it, October? Get out of here. I don't pay until, like, March, anyway.
Oh, as soon as I walk through the door, you got your dues? I said, well, if I give you money for dues, I ain't got no money to buy nothing. I'd rather buy something.
The last 2 years, I've been paying with PayPal. But I have to pay more. I have to pay a couple of dollars more. Because they don't want to be... They don't want to be hammered for the charge. So I figured, a couple of dollars is probably worth it for me.
Hey, you come join my club. We don't pay any extra for paying by PayPal.
And they even have it locked in like that. In other words, like, you know, you click on where you send the money, and it comes back saying, no, it's, you know, and it shows, like, $2, 13 cents more, or something like that. And actually, like, you can't get away from it. Yeah, I haven't figured out like that, so that's wild.
Yeah, well, we worked out a deal with PayPal, and our fee is a lot less than that per transaction like that. So we don't pass that along. We need that. We need the little tiny little chunk of change that it is. Yeah, so yeah, it's I tell you, attendance was down. Not all the vendor stations were there. I did not see Andy CDL there with his tune-up clinic up on the stage. So, and I probably still made a decent amount of money, but like I said, attendance was down, and yeah, my guys sold a bunch of this stuff. They got rid of stuff they wanted to get rid of. Make room for their new stuff.
I had a guy talk to me about, he's not a ham radio operator, he's going to be one, and he said he's out there, I think in West Babylon, and he's like about two bucks. He goes, you know what I got?